Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is another week of Zero Point Radio. This show is about mystical and spiritual teachings and how these relate to modern science. It's about studies of consciousness and the heart. And also we look at the broader world situation and dynamics of what's happening in society and have broader discussions. The main aim is to present a form of mystical science, which is synthesizing ideas from the mystical teachings of humankind and looking at those mystical ideas in a scientific viewpoint and trying to understand them through integrating them with science. From a mystical perspective, there are fundamental mistakes made in modern thought, modern psychology, and modern science. So a mystical perspective allows us a whole alternative way of interpreting many of the phenomena of science and seeing things in a different light. My background is psychology, and I've been studying the esoteric traditions of psychology for 30 years now, as well as studying in modern psychology and science. In the background, I have James Moffat, and James is a contributor, and we hold discussions on a wide range of topics. Jim, are you there?
I'm here, yep.
Yeah, welcome, Jim.
Good afternoon, yeah. Nice to be back.
Okay. So to the listener, I invite you to attend or to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. And I have a wide selection of my writings and materials up on my website. And I have a number of books there, especially I think the series I've produced called Within, Without, From Zero Points. This series is a profoundly important series, and it provides an alternate model of what a human being is, saying that we ourselves as human beings actually have a zero-point center. This is like a mystical center we have, and that actually exists, I would say, in terms of the physics of the quantum vacuum. So to understand what a human being is, we really have to understand the nature of space and the nature of the quantum vacuum and the zero-point fields within which we live and move and have our being. So to understand, from my perspective, the enigmas of human consciousness, it ties us into having to look at the nature of modern physics and the nature of the world, because consciousness exists within the world in the space-time complex. So to understand consciousness, we have to understand the physics and metaphysics of consciousness. So the teachings you get here represent a very unique viewpoint vis-a-vis other materials you'll read in the consciousness literature. The mainstream of modern thought has articulated what I call the head doctrine, which is the belief that the brain in the head produces consciousness, and that consciousness is centered mainly within the head. In the mystical traditions, the heart is seen as the center of self within a living being. The self is within the heart, and this is taught in the Upanishads of ancient India, which are approximately 3,000 to 5,000 years old, the mystical descriptions of the self, the cave of Brahman within the lotus of the heart. And it's in the Bhagavad Gita, as Lord Krishna says, I am the self seated within the hearts of all living beings. And we find that Christ is within the heart in the Christian tradition. And the way to know God is through the awakening of the heart and love of God entailing the heart. And in Sufism, we see Rumi searching everywhere for God, and then in the end of his tale, he finds God in his only place within mine own heart, he says. And we have the people go to the prophet asking him to speak of self-knowledge, and he says, your minds long to know the wisdom of the heart. So the idea is that the deeper level of self is associated with the heart, the actual physical and metaphysical nature of the heart. And that is the I that a human being is. Although a human being, we all the time say I this and I that, in modern science, no scientist thinks that there is a singular I in the human being. So the idea that there's an I is just kind of imaginary. It's the way we learn to speak, to refer to ourselves. But the scientist doesn't think that there is some I in the human being. Instead, they think the illusion of self or illusion of I involves certain cerebral processes in the prefrontal and temporal cortices of the brain. They think that gives us our sense of self or our social identity. But they don't think that there is a deep level to self, which is as is articulated within the mystical tradition, because the self within the heart is described first as infinitesimal, like a zero-point source. The idea there's a point source origination of consciousness within the human being, just like our universe emerged from a singularity condition. So I'm suggesting within the human being, consciousness emerges from a singularity condition. And so we're rooted through different dimensions of space and of zero-point fields. So a human being, really, we exist on different interpenetrating planes of being. And we exist in these different interpenetrating planes all the time, simultaneously. But our consciousness is only attuned to certain frequencies of vibrations, and so we're limited in our awareness of this multidimensional world we live in. So we identify ourselves most with the physical body and the material world, and we think we're only material organisms. So modern psychology and science has dismissed the study of the soul for over a century. And they have this pseudo-scientific model of material Darwinian evolution, or kind of evolution by fortunate genetic mutations and such. Kind of haphazard evolutionary process, they think, proceeded mechanically, rather than they're seeing there as being some informing principle within living beings. Something, some intelligence that is embodied in the organisms that arise. So whereas modern science sees us mainly as material organisms, from a mystical perspective, I would say we have a material nature, a psychical nature related to the psyche and the mind and the moon, and then we have a spiritual nature related to the self and the heart and the sun. And then we have a divine nature, which is a divine element and divine source emanation. So this is like a singularly monadic essence. And I say that this monadic essence in the human being is at the core of your being, is a monadic essence. And around this monadic essence, different bodies form, so that monadic essence is clothed in different bodies, and the bodies form around this central point. And as these bodies form around the central point, then we're clothed in mental matters, and then astral matters, and material matters. We come into the physical form. And I would say once death occurs, the physical body drops away, but you still have the subtle bodies, the astral and mental bodies, which still surround the central point and allow you to experience and function within other dimensions of existence. From my perspective as a scientist, it was 25, 30 years ago, I studied the research on near-death experiences and other psychical phenomena and realized how much really there's a huge volume of evidences, all which testify to the paranormal nature of life, that life isn't simply material organisms that live and die with the body. There was evidence for out-of-body experiences, ESP, ghosts, psychokinesis, just ESP, clairvoyance, all these different kinds of psychical phenomena and manifestations. And these have been a part of the history of humanity. And in more modern times, we've had this huge volume of near-death experiences and people experiencing visiting other realms or going down a tunnel into a realm of light. Or we see people on TV who channel and who seem to have be able to contact people on the other side existing in other dimensions. So it was 30 years ago, I kind of became convinced, oh yeah, all these things are true. So instead of always squabbling, as many people do, about whether there's evidence to prove the existence of these things, I let that drop aside and just accepted these things exist. So how can we develop a model of the nature of reality that allows us to understand how these things work from a scientific viewpoint? So I felt we needed to develop a new model of science that can explain these phenomena and how they might occur. So in my own writings, I've dealt most with the idea that a human being has a zero-point center and that the creation of a human being is very analogous to the creation of the universe or cosmos, as above, so below. The patterns of creation in the creation of the universe are the same inherent patterns within the inner microcosm of a human being, that there's this. And both of these entail a form of higher dimensional physics. In mystical views of creation of the universe, everything in a way emerges out of nothingness, because mystical accounts of creation depict the time before creation begins, and then they depict creation as emerging from a zero-point source, an infinitesimal dot, is how it's described in Kabbalah. Or Blavatsky calls it the zero point. So the mystics for hundreds and even thousands of years have postulated that the cosmos originated from a point source. And before that, it came out of the realm of nothingness, which is described as paradoxically nothingness, but also as the plenum, meaning containing all potencies and abundance in itself. So mystics have described the kind of root principles of creation as a form of nothingness, which is the plenum, and that living beings have zero-point centers. So I'm trying to show, in a way, how these ideas from Kabbalah and Blavatsky, these correspond, we can tie these into modern concepts about the creation, what's called vacuum genesis, creation out of the quantum vacuum. And then the universe began from a singularity point, a 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And then it ballooned into something the size of a grapefruit, is how one scientist describes it. That is what Blavatsky would describe as the dropping of the world egg. So from a point, you balloon into an egg condition. In terms of a human being, I would say you have a singularity, divine source, element which is brought down into the heart space, or is in the interior most of the heart space, a divine source emanation. And then from there, that balloons out into what is called the bliss sheath in the heart. The bliss sheath in the heart is described as the size of a small grape. It's described in a book called The Science of the Soul. Sarasvati describes it. He says, the golden sheath of the divine city is a mass of light filled with bliss, has its abode in the subtle area of a grape-sized hollow of this physical heart, the repository of blood. It is in the castle of this causal sheath that the immortal individual soul abides, with its supreme protectos, all-powerful, omniscient, adorable Father God. The temple of a yogi is inside the heart alone. they're the nectar of divinity, the nectar of bliss, the bliss sheet, or Ananda Maya Kosha. So the concept is that we have like the singularity idea of the divine source emanation, but then it is ensouled into something the size of a small grape, and that's called the bliss sheep. So when the person, in the mystical point of view, when a person says, I would say intuitively that person is, refers to the bliss sheep, the singular element within the subtle dimensions of the heart. That is real I. And mystics described as we come into the physical body and we grow up in life, our mind becomes more and more conditioned by everything around us and our life experiences and physical, emotional, and mentally. In all three areas, we become more and more conditioned by things around us. And the awareness of this, these subtle dimensions of ourselves, can diminish from our awareness. And more the mind in the head, which I would say is the center of the egoic nature. The ego is in the mind, in the brain, in the head. So that comes to dominate. And similarly, modern scientists have all assumed that the head and the brain is where, that's where yourself is, or the illusion of self, and that's where consciousness is, all up in the head. Whereas in the mystical traditions, it is said we have to strive towards the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart, and then learn to live in the consciousness of the heart. And then somehow there is a science to this, that the consciousness of the heart can then expand in various ways, or be filled with light, or be vacated, or there are mystical experiences associated with the depths of the human heart. And as that happens, and that card is awakened as a center of self within yourself, and the increased illumination of consciousness can then illuminate higher faculties of the mind in the head as well. So what I'm to do through this radio series is try to explain some of the complexities of these teachings, and it's a complex kind of subject. And takes considerable time to understand and grow in understanding of it. As you know, these are deep mystery teachings. The ancient teaching of the heart, that what I call the heart doctrine, is an esoteric, it's a hidden teaching. It's in all of the religions. It's in all of the religions. It's in Christianity, Judaism, it's in Islam, it's in Sufism, it's in Tibetan Buddhism, it's in Native American teachings. The heart is seen, regarded as the essential source of the self and of God. The Father is associated with the heart. So I'm saying we need to consider this framework of ideas very seriously, because this is a whole alternative scientific theory and model of the nature of creation, which doesn't deny all the evidences for all the psychical phenomena. See, we need a model of creation that allows us to understand how all these other things, the healings and ghosts and afterlife and reincarnation and near-death experiences, all these phenomena, how, what is the mechanism of all these events? There has to be a physics and metaphysics to these things. If there's afterlife existence in subtle dimensions, we can go to heaven or we can go to purgatory or hell, there must be a physics and metaphysics to how all these things work. By definition, there just has to be a science of it. So we're trying to understand these types of realms within the scientific perspective. So that's generally what this series is about, the Zero Point Radio. It's about trying to explain the idea of zero points, looking at the mysteries of the heart, the mysteries of consciousness, the idea of there being multidimensional existence. We go across science and religion, and as well as looking at other aspects of the world about us. Okay, so that I usually like to take a bit of time at the beginning of the show just to give some kind of seminar, lecture, or whatever. And then now I'd like to open it up and welcome my guest, James Moffitt, in. And Jim.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on any? Whenever I try to talk about these teachings, it always comes out differently somehow.
Well, yeah, and I think it was an interesting presentation of some of the basic ideas. I mean, there's so many elements to this whole teaching, this whole model that you've kind of derived from mystical and esoteric teachings and developed that you can start in different points, but the fundamental basis of what makes us so different from the modern scientific ideas about the nature of everything, the nature of reality, is that it's a different model of consciousness. And on a psychological level, that leads to a very different understanding of what human beings are and what they can become. And everything kind of, everything else in the model takes on an entirely different new meaning because of this different perspective on the nature of consciousness. And it's really a counterweight to the dominant paradigm in modern science, which is a materialist reductionist perspective. Sorry, I have a little cat fight going on here in the background. It's a counterweight to that. I was struck by, and you were talking earlier about paranormal phenomena, and that's one thing that always really I thought was very interesting, and how you developed your ideas was just what you just said, was that rather than trying to, you know, sift through all the evidence and weigh all the debate about all these alleged paranormal phenomena, you kind of took the attitude that realistically it seemed to you that there was more than enough evidence to suggest the reality of these phenomena. And then rather than being stuck in that debate, trying to understand, well, if there is validity to these things, how is it possible? And this comes back to, in my mind, to the skeptical perspective on paranormal phenomena, is that they say, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and they're always very rigorous in terms of experimental evidence for paranormal phenomena. They're always very rigorous and very critical of the studies, and that this could be faked, and that this is shoddy work and everything, which on a certain level I completely agree with, and I think you would too, is that, you know, good science is good science, and it doesn't matter what you're investigating. But when you really look a little closer, you realize that the idea of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, one of the reasons why these are extraordinary claims is because it doesn't fit. They don't fit into the materialist model of consciousness and reality. And if you have an alternative model, then they're not so extraordinary. I mean, they're still extraordinary in a sense, but they're not as extraordinary because there's a way of explaining them. And that's what I find about the mystical perspective and mystical esoteric perspective on consciousness allows for these things, because first and foremost, it doesn't say that consciousness is produced in the brain, but rather that consciousness exists in a variety of different levels, and that it informs the psychic functions in a human being. Like, consciousness is something that isn't produced by the physical body and by the electrochemical processes in the brain. It's actually a property of reality.
Yeah, and I think that brings us most, I would say, to the equation of consciousness with light.
Yeah.
I think that, like, in what I'm in terms of studying Western psychology, like, where I began, and it was influenced by William James, who equated consciousness with the stream of thoughts and feelings and sensations and volitions and the like. So the kind of stream of different experiences, that as a whole was what they meant by consciousness. Whereas in a mystical tradition, you differentiate consciousness is separate from the psychic functions of thinking, feeling, or sensation. And consciousness is like light, or is not like light, it is light, it's illuminating, it's electromagnetic, and that consciousness illuminates what goes on in the mind and in the emotions and in the body. And that it's this illumination of consciousness that allows us to be conscious of all these thoughts and feelings and sensations and so on. But consciousness is something substantively different than the psychological functions. So that kind of then ties into having a view, as you're suggesting, of consciousness as being substantive. Being meaning it's something in itself, and in the mystical tradition that is light. And in Tibetan Buddhism, the Dalai Lama describes individual consciousness as a reflection of the mind of clear light. And in his model of consciousness, there's a mind of clear light, and then there are what he calls empty space particles, minute empty space particles. So that's kind of what I'm saying, is that there's this consciousness of light and then empty space particles. And it's the interaction of these things that somehow metaphysically produces consciousness.
Would you, I'm not quite sure I grasped that last point about empty space. What are the empty space particles? Like, how does that relate to the light? I'm not sure I grasped that.
Well, different times I describe the heart as having a different nature. Sometimes I emphasize the idea that there is a divine source emanation, okay, and that's like a divine spark or a point source of supernal light, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the self described as a star in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other whole aspect to the heart is a vacated space.
Right.
In Kabbalah, that's called the zimzum, which means a withdrawal. So an empty space is created within the heart. Before the empty space is created, everything is filled with infinite light. So you had to kind of withdraw the infinite light, and it vacated the space. So when I try to understand consciousness, I'm saying we have to understand the concept of there being like a divine spark existing within an emptied space.
That was going to be my next question. So are you saying that God withdraws the light and there's this empty space and then there's a divine spark and that the individual consciousness arises within that space? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd say when the infinite light is withdrawn, there's a central point, a divine source emanation in the center, and the light is withdrawn around it. So you have a star in space, a point within the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And that emptied space is really the seven-dimensional ether. It's the ethers of space. Like, that's the divine mother. It's like the father and mother principles. The divine spark is the father principle.
And it's
established within space.
And so is it empty and
mother.
Full at the same time?
Sorry, Jim?
Is it empty and full at the same time?
It's emptied. It's seemingly empty now.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
But it is inherently full.
Yeah.
So that when a line of light, so when the plenum then becomes illuminated by the light of consciousness, the emptiness is revealed not to have been empty.
Yeah.
But all the potencies are revealed late that are latent in the emptiness.
Yeah.
So in the emptiness, I would say, like, it's a seven-dimensional emptiness. It's like in Kabbalah, you have the supernal triad above, and the seven sephira below are all born out of the divine mother, which is Bana. So the seven spheres below are called the lesser sephira, compared with the supernal triad. So the seven lesser sephira, seven realms of creation, are all latent in Bana. So the vacated space in the heart is like what I'm saying. It's like the quantum vacuum, but it has an inherent seven-dimensional nature to it. And then, so that's a zero-point field. Like if you put a point on a page of paper, and then you drew seven circles around it. See, in a way, that point could represent the self established in the seven-dimensional, like seven dimensions of the ethers, the seven planes of existence. So I see ourselves as differentiating within without from such zero-point sources established in higher-dimensional space. And this creates dimensions around the central point. I mean, I wouldn't want to try to pretend I understand all the dynamics of these things, Jim, in a way, but it gives you some of the concepts of, that I would try to evoke.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting because it's the more, you know, I explore these things and the more you articulate them, the more I read, you know, about these different ideas, what I'm always struck by is how incredibly elegant and utterly rational they are. Like, I mean, I don't pretend to know whether or not this is true, but it's certainly, you know, as somebody with a scientific background, a scientific training, it certainly sort of satisfies me in terms of the theoretical aspects of it. It's quite beautiful, and it's quite, you know, it's quite in keeping with everything else I know. There's nothing in this that I'd say, oh, well, that's, you know, completely ridiculous because it doesn't fit. But
The other
side of it too is that when I think about this, you know, I've been thinking a lot for the last couple of weeks about the contrast between the mystical esoteric perspective and the modern scientific perspective on everything, on the nature of consciousness and the nature of reality, whether or not God exists, the soul, and everything. And I'm really struck that in modern psychology, you really, when they talk about consciousness, really there's only two states of consciousness that modern psychology recognizes. You're either asleep or you're awake. And when you're awake, there's nothing that recognized in modern psychology or science in the sense that consciousness can be transformed or can be elevated or expanded or in any way depart from the norm. Like any kind of experience outside of the norm is seen as an anomaly, but it's not seen as something that can be produced voluntarily or that should be produced voluntarily. And it's just kind of shunted to the side. And you were talking about William James earlier, and there's a very famous quote from William James about the nature of consciousness when he says that, you know, that all around us there are all these other potential modes of consciousness which, you know, are separated from us by the thinnest film, and that we can experience these. And it's like it's quoted all the time in psychology textbooks and psychology books, but nobody ever kind of, you know, delves into trying to understand what's meant by that. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of given its recognition, but there's no recognition that, you know, for thousands of years in the mystical and esoteric tradition, people have taken this very seriously and have explored these ideas and produced these incredible representations of what consciousness is and have produced these, you know, inspirational accounts of experiencing directly these higher states of consciousness. So in a sense, I was struck because I was reading Carl Sagan's Gifford lectures, which were given in 1985 and have been reproduced just recently. And he talks about the beauty of science and the elegance and the grandness of it all. And the more I think about mystical and esoteric teachings, especially in terms of their representation of consciousness, the more I'm so impressed by, you know, how all those adjectives would apply to that tradition. And really, modern psychology is very unimaginative and kind of provincial in its outlook, which is exactly what Sagan kind of, you know, criticizes about religious and mystical viewpoints. You know, I'd say the opposite, that really it's science that has a very kind of limited understanding of things and a very limited perspective, a very useful perspective in a lot of ways. But
it's only in some areas that science is so limited. Like, it's not limited in its application within the physical domain as much.
And the material realm is quite brilliant. that's all. But I guess the category mistake is that they assume that that's all there is, that there's nothing beyond that perspective. And that's kind of the inherent flaw in the whole approach, is to not recognize that, you know, these are other realms, metaphysical, subtle realms, that they are somehow, you know, involved in the manifestation of the material realm. That's what I would say, that's the great kind of shortcoming in modern science.
Yeah, that's how at one point I realized, modern science is really pseudoscientific. That's what I realized because of the kind of juvenile way in which they dismiss evidences for all these phenomena and dismiss evidences for other models of consciousness. I realized that really, when it came to these areas of study, modern science was really pseudoscientific, and that really mystical teachings offered the more advanced science of these other areas.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's like that great quote from Rene Weber, the philosopher who had a book, Dialogues with Scientists and Sages, and she says that, you know, both science and religion seek the knowledge of the unity, to seek to know the one, and that ironically, in a sense, it may be mysticism that is more scientific than modern science, in the sense that because it involves the observer himself in the quest to realize unity, it surpasses science, which wants to stand apart. You know, the observer always wants to separate himself to be a quote unquote objective. Whereas in the mystical tradition, you know, the observer is a participant in knowing the ultimate reality and knowing the ultimate unity of things. That's one of those things that, you know, I completely agree with you. The more I kind of look at how sort of hidebound and how intolerant scientists are of these ideas, the more I realize that in a very real sense, despite all its achievements, science is pseudoscientific in its attitude towards the mystical and esoteric tradition and the realities that it describes.
Yeah. And how and these all bear upon issues then in other areas of science, like it's all relevant to understanding like evolutionary theory and issues of like the growth of the biological organism. Like from our perspective, more I'd say ours as mystics and scientists, having both perspectives, like there are underlying subtle bodies in the physics of the human body. So just like the way acupuncture works, there are these meridians in acupuncture. Now acupuncture works, it works, you see that, so the evidence suggests it works in certain areas, okay? But there's no known mechanism for it to work because its meridians don't correspond to anything seen physically. But instead, the meridians exist within the subtle bodies. So we're saying there's a whole subtle, higher dimensional kind of physics to the human body of underlying fields, which so the human being, in a way, is informed. Like there's an intelligence and life that emerges within without, and that brings life into the body, and the growth is influenced by these underlying fields originating in this higher dimensional process. So,
yeah, and I mean, as you say, the implications for all sorts of different issues in science, you know, evolutionary theory, medicine, if we could really understand the nature of these subtle dimensions and how they inform things. I mean, you say, you know, there's no known mechanism to explain how acupuncture works. Well, of course, not in terms of Western science, but of course, in terms of Chinese medicine, they have a very sophisticated understanding of how this works. But they don't believe, you know, in the material perspective. It's, you know, I receive acupuncture treatments from time to time and quite successfully, and it's kind of funny when, you know, I talk to my naturopath and he says to me, I said something about nerves and he says, well, you know, in Chinese medicine, we don't believe in nerves. You know, it's kind of like, well, somebody with a background in psychology, you know, like you don't believe in nerves, you know, like what? You know, but having said that, if you have sinusitis and you have a choice of antibiotics or acupuncture, I would recommend going with the acupuncture myself based on my own experiences. So, you know, a variety of other complaints too. I mean, and that's the thing is that really what's so exciting, and I mean, this is, in terms of your work, I mean, I would really urge people who are listening to this and who are interested to purchase your Within Without series, at least start with the book on the heart doctrine, because there's so many issues that you raise here, and there's so much more work to be done, but it's just fascinating because it's all consistent and coherent. It's internally consistent and it's coherent, the kind of the model that you're developing. And it would be really interesting to, you know, I'm sure all sorts of people, if they were to study this, would have ideas about how this model could be developed, you know. But it certainly leads to a very different understanding of ourselves, the nature of the universe, basically every big issue, you know. What's the nature of religion, the nature of science, the nature of everything?
Yeah, it's amazing in that, like, it offers a whole alternative position, but it's a position which can be scientifically evaluated and explored. Like, yeah, that's what's so remarkable about it. Like,
yeah, and as Westerners, I mean, I think that, you know, that in our time, I mean, I think that's appropriate. I think it would be, I mean, neither of us are anti-scientific in any way, but we kind of see the limits of science, or believe that we see the limits of science, and how this really leads to a much more comprehensive perspective, you know. And I mean, in terms of psychology, I would say that psychology is definitely, modern psychology is definitely a pseudoscience, and that really 9/10 of the work that's done in psychology could end tomorrow and the human race would be much better off for it. You know, I think it's a complete waste of time and resources, you know, and that's as somebody who was trained as a psychologist.
Yeah, there's such basic misunderstandings, I would say, that then limits the value of everything else that's done.
Yeah, and such frivolous kind of questions that so much of psychology is devoted to. It's idiotic.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very intelligent. It's like, you know, one of the gurus talking about that is like, you know, that scientists aren't very intelligent. I mean, at times you realize that so much of what passes for scientific inquiry is really, you know, it's just frivolous, or it's, you know, the great phrase that William McGuire, a social psychologist, had about, said that most of social psychology was simple demonstrations of obvious truths. You know,
yeah.
The scientific search for, you know, for the study of psychology. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, even if you get a positive result, so what? You know, what does that prove? Nothing that we didn't already know. It's just kind of, you know, spinning your wheels for no ostensible
purpose. Yeah, they have no underlying model of the nature of a human being. In the sense of
exactly.
Psychology, and
yeah,
I mean, mainly it's, they view people dualistically, mind and body, and in that simplistic way. And then there's no study of the heart and soul, so that is wholly lacking. And then the view of no one's, the issue of consciousness has always kind of been outside of the mainstream. People haven't considered that an important issue. Whereas then you go to mystical teachings, and that is the fundamental issue.
Yeah, and it is a fundamental issue.
It is
even to us human beings,
it's a fundamental issue. You know,
yeah,
because that is asking, like, what is the nature of I? What am I?
What am,
like,
I?
Am I just this body, or is there something deeper going on here? You know, it's directly relevant to all of us, whether we just have one material life and we live and we die and that's it, or do we live on and have another life and be back in a few years and carry on again and see if we can do better or live in other realms and dimensions. I mean, it would be wonderful, in my view, to have such multidimensional existence. Now, the fact that it would be wonderful doesn't make it true, but it doesn't make it untrue.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, I mean, imagine how that would extend our understanding of what we are if we really realized we had many lives in different dimensions. I mean, then, like, wow, you know, we're just stuck down here at the moment, but we might be such higher dimensional organisms, you know. It's a whole alternate model of what we are and directly relevant to our life issues.
Yeah, you know, I'm always kind of struck too, because in a sense, a lot of, I think, of the work that I do in terms of studying myself and seeking to, you know, develop consciousness, I realize it's still rooted in my own ego and my own identification with myself, you know, and it's, in a way, as you know, as important as it is in some sense, it's still kind of rooted in sort of a very kind of childish, juvenile, you know, attachment to myself. But that's part of the growing pains. But then, you know, you realize when you read that there is other aspects. It's like, you know, in Gurdjieff's work, he says that, you know, that we have a duty to lighten the sorrows of our Creator, His endlessness, you know. And then you realize there's a whole kind of moral and ethical responsibility that comes with this, that it's, you know, a lot of people, I think that that mysticism is self-indulgent and narcissistic, and that's an escape from reality. But really, normal living is narcissistic, self-indulgent, and escape from reality, and that really the mystic quest is, you know, poses all sorts of responsibilities and challenges to grow and to serve something higher than you know, your normal egoic processes.
Yeah, it's funny that I think people ordinarily think they know what reality is. And that's the problem, because in the way they don't know at all what that it really is. They think they know reality, and then something, I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, I think that's pretty good right there. Exactly. I think that's exactly true.
But people, even the reality of our world situation, like,
or reality,
people think they know the reality of the world. People have no idea of what's really behind human history and the influences and powers and entities and happenings behind human history. Instead, the whole of Western society, talking about Western society, has had a mind hypnosis imposed on it, and a whole way of understanding and believing engendered through the media and the news and all these things, intentionally controlled. And in a way, Western civilization has been hypnotized into this whole wrong way of understanding and living. And that's like this whole mind hypnosis. I think waking up is when you begin to see more and more what that hypnosis has entailed, and the deception and misunderstanding, how we've been conditioned.
Oh, I wanted to mention one thing, which I just got a note today that today is Gurdjieff's birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was born in, there are different dates attributed to it, but William Patrick Patterson says he believes 1872. Some people have said 1866. Some people have said 1877. But he thinks most likely 1872. He burned all his papers when he was about 1930. Burned his passports and his personal papers, so nobody really knows exactly. You know, he did say that this was his birthday, though. So, yeah. And I mean, you know, when going back to, like, Gurdjieff was the first esoteric teacher I really studied, and you know, still probably definitely is the most influential in terms of my own thinking, and you know, even though I've, like, explored other teachings and know other things, I'm sort of grounded in the fourth way teaching, and I can still kind of remember the shocking effect when, just apropos of what you were just saying about the hypnosis, that when he said, you know, that we're all sleepwalkers, that we live in a state of subjective associative existence, and that you know, everything that people do, they, you know, they write books, and, you know, they do all these different things, but they do them in sleep, you know, and that the history of the world is a history of sleep, you know, and I can still remember kind of the shock of that when I first started to study myself and realized, well, I'm asleep, and started to realize that, well, everybody's asleep, you know, and that you can just see it, you can kind of feel it. When you're first introduced to that idea, it's so shocking to start to consider it as a realistic possibility, that, and then you kind of have these episodes where you see instances where people are very much completely asleep, and it's just so obvious to you, you know.
Yeah, how mechanically everything happens.
Everything
how
happens.
How people are,
yeah,
conditioned,
which is,
and controlled, and led to believe. You know, I see that now, how much people have been led to believe I like Gurdjieff also has that interesting story about the black magician.
Oh, yeah.
And he has a flock of sheep, and he wants to slaughter the sheep, but he wants them to stay quiet and be pacified until they're ready to be slaughtered, eh?
Yeah, not to run away.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So what does he do? Oh, the black magician persuades the sheep that they're not really sheep, that they're really eagles, and they're magicians, and
yeah.
So on. And then he kind of, is that the end of the story?
He hypnotizes them.
Oh, yeah.
Some believe that they're magicians, and some believe that they're eagles, and, you know, some believe that they're, you know, they believe everything but what they are, which is that sheep, and then they're easy to slaughter.
Yeah.
And they
stay in that position.
Yeah, and so they're put in their place by a false belief system about themselves.
Yeah, I see that. That's kind of like how I see the mass of Western civilization at this time, is like we've been so deceived by the mainstream media, and all going back to the truth of 9/11 and the fantasy that was concocted around 9/11.
Oh, I think
that huge deceit. And then you see all the war things going on now, and I just on an international level just see these are maniacs kind of who have this kind of imperialistic terrorist, that we're the terrorists, you know.
Well,
always thought, oh, you know, United States will save the world, you know, I believed in democracy and freedom and stuff like this, and now all of a sudden I'm saying, holy smokes, we're terrorizing people, we're the terrorists, it's not... We've kind of been deceived to think it's one thing, and the whole time it's something completely different.
Well,
understanding of thinking, you know, America is some big democracy. It's not at all.
Well,
it was bought out long ago.
I would say that it goes way back beyond 9/11. There's a really good book called The Press and the Cold War by James Aronson, who was a left-wing journalist in the United States, and started the New Guardian Weekly, which is a newspaper that came out, and he was persecuted under the McCarthy era, the book deals with the Cold War, but it actually deals with the history of the American media in the 20th century, and really, you know, it just kind of shows that, it's a very well-written, very well-documented book. You just realize that there's so many lies told and so much, you know, BS that imposed on people about how things happen and why they happen. It's like, you know, anybody who takes any of this seriously in terms of believing it is, you know, really needs to open their eyes, because there's so much more to what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
Whoever controls the, you know, the media in terms of money and power, really controls the message, and I mean...
Yeah, the mass consciousness, or so-called consciousness.
Yeah, you know, it's a form of hypnosis, and that's why that wonderful essay that Henry Miller wrote called Murder the Murderer, which he started during the Second World War, in which he addresses to his friend who had enlisted as a private in the French Army during the Second World War. And Miller was an anarchist in the sense that he just didn't believe in governments, and he didn't believe in causes, and he didn't believe in anything. And he criticizes the whole picture that's drawn of the Second World War and of all wars, basically. And it's a psychological analysis of things. It's not a political analysis. It's grounded in psychology. And the thing is, this is written over several years. It was in two parts, but it was written during the 40s and beginning during the war and then after the war. And the predictions he makes are much more astute than anything that any political analyst would have written during that period. You know, it's amazing. He says at one point, you know, the atomic bomb is just the first little present that these geniuses are going to provide us with. It's just a matter of time before the heavens themselves will be invaded by weapons. You know, and I'm thinking, boy, how can this guy who's this heretic, you know, who's saying everything which is the opposite of what we're told, how can he be so right on in his analysis of things? Well, it's because he doesn't buy any of the cover story, and he tries to understand things psychologically. It's like, it's very, very impressive, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's funny now. I I mean, I've never been a political person, and it's only over the last months that I really kind of awoke more to the seriousness of the human situation, you know. And I never could really believe that there would be groups and beings so devious as to kind of devise and control and have such world schemes, all from hidden in a way. Like now I see it like that. Even, have you ever watched anything on that place, Bohemian Grove in California?
I've heard of it, but yeah.
Where people gather and they have they worship this, I forget the real name of it. I call the big horny owl because it's a big owl bowl or something. And the roots of this are supposed to go back like to Sumerian times or something.
I think it's Baal.
Baal?
Yeah.
Okay, so this great horny owl, a horned owl probably, and they have this ceremony called the Sacrifice of Care. And this place, it's been visited. It's visited by the Bushes, like there are major people there, and Clinton and Kissinger and all these people, and kind of take part in this. And the, you know, these people identified as being in with the Illuminati and controlling all the media and devising all these devious things. Like more, I never could have really conceived seriously that this was all such a conspiracy, you know. I would have, oh, that's conspiracy theory, but now I realize, wow, it wasn't all theories all along. It's like the whole Western society was so deceived, you know. 9/11 was one thing that showed us that, but the assassination of Kennedy, you know, the very fact that the Kennedy was never properly investigated. So then you look at, well, why wasn't it properly investigated? The evidence is kind of are all there, and these things never got dealt with, kind of. I mean, these evidences are all there through human history of these kind of hidden other things being done, while the populations are kind of deceived as to what is being done.
Yeah, I guess on some level, for me, it's just like sex and power and money, you know? I mean, you don't have to go much further than that, really. Like, I mean, I'm not sure that I buy every, you know, well, I mean, it's a huge, you know, variety of theories about what's really going on, you know? And I mean, I have my own opinions about different things. I mean, I you know, study the Kennedy assassination for 35 years, you know, and I know only one thing. I know that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, but, you know, when it gets right down to it, the base motive is the desire for sex and power and money, you know. It's like it's rooted in the base chakras, as you would say, you know. It's feeding the lower nature of people, which is what drives people, and I mean, that's in a sense, too, why it's so important to understand like this different alternative of what we are as human beings, what we could be and what we should be, and that why it's important to awaken. You know, it's like I was telling you off the air that I was reading Dafri John's book, The Transmission of Doubt, in which he does an analysis of the modern science and the materialist position, and he criticizes it. But the bottom line, as he says, is it's essentially an egoic process, you know, that people are contracted about their hearts, and they're rooted in these egoic processes, and it leads to a false understanding of themselves and the nature of the universe. You know, as he says, science is a wonderful tool. He's not anti-scientific, but the mistake that people make is that they think that this is all there is, you know, that they don't understand that if they could awaken to their true nature as, you know, in I think what he calls the radiant luminescence, that, they, you know, basically if you know, if you lived in the light, you would have a very different understanding of everything, you know, especially yourself. And also, like, what the other thing that really struck me from what he talks about is that science is based on this idea that objective knowledge involves a withdrawal from things and an externalization of everything, that you have to see it from an external perspective. You know, you have to distance yourself from it to understand it, whereas the mystical tradition prescribes exactly the opposite. You have to realize that all the divisions between yourself and the world are essentially projections of your own consciousness, and that if you were really awake, that you would be at one with everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes. Ultimately, the level of realization is like the unity of all creation.
And it's kind of like all that, the mystical models and the Kabbalistic tree of life or Gurdjieff's way of creation. I mean, it's not that you can't see that there are different divisions within creation and that you can't analyze them and break them down. You can, but ultimately that experience of unity is the real goal of knowing and the real basis of wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much between here and there too, like our lower states versus the most supreme states. Like, I think there are whole other ways in which you can experience within like a higher dimensional level and interact with the larger world on a higher dimensional level. Like in Gurdjieff calls it objective consciousness. Being aware of things within the subtle worlds that objectively exist.
Yeah.
Like what I was saying before about, understanding. Now, I see it conceivable that I've never believed in Satan, but I can believe in, like, these really dark beings who even with alien influences. I mean, I consider seriously the possibility of reptilian and the little grays and other options to these alien beings. And I can even see some alien beings feed off humanity through the subtle dimensions and try to invade. And so I believe much more that these beings act through the ethers in a way on humankind, and even like I would say in a way some of these beings want to feed off human blood and fear, and it's like Gurdjieff says, at certain times, like, it's like the planets need a certain amount of like war, so you can, every time anything organic dies, a certain energy feeds the moon, he says.
Yeah.
So I can imagine these beings kind of living off vital energies from human beings through the loss of life and the feeding off the soul life of human beings. I'm not saying I know this to be true. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
Even. But I'm saying now I have an extended view of the nature of these forces. I don't think the forces that underlie what's happened in modern society, I don't think it's just ordinary individual men who are, wanting money, sex, and power. I think it's something much more devious and multidimensional and unknown to us with these roots. Like, I think if you went back, I watched a very interesting movie on the internet the other day. Actually, one of them was called Orwell Rolls Over in His Grave. It was all about the media and looking back. Actually, I'm not sure that's the movie I was trying to refer to. That was one of the movies which was shocking, and the role of the media at the Ministry of Doublethink. Like, you just see it, how kind of the Western society at the moment is invading Arab lands and taking over Arab lands, and then we label people in that part of the world who fight back, those are terrorists, kind of. But we don't see what we're doing. Like, yeah. We're the ones, we're the aggressors. That's what's going to happen next. You can see, the escalation of things, what Bush has in mind, Next, it's Iran and Syria. Those are next on the hit list, Well, and so this process is unfolding, and it reminds me of Ruth Benson.
He's kind of out of time, I think, you know.
Sorry, Jim?
He's kind of out of time. I mean, you know, he's not going to be able to do that. I mean, you know.
Well, that's what he suggested in his speech.
That's what he wanted to do before, but, I mean, he's not going to be able to do that.
I don't really know. I don't know, but
I'm telling you politically, he doesn't have enough time. I mean, he's going to be out of office in another year and a bit, you know. No, he's not going to. He was, I mean, they were definitely considering attacking Iran. I mean, that was reported in the New Yorker about a year and a half ago by Seymour Hersh, but.
It's also been reported in other media sources over the last weeks and months.
But at this point, like, it's just, you know, I don't think that's going to happen, you know. But it doesn't matter. I mean, the more basic point is that, you know, it's like, it's the old thing, you know, about one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, you know. It's a whole kind of screaming about, you know, Saddam Hussein, that there's a Middle East madman, but, you know, he used to be our buddy, you know. We supplied him with weapons. I mean, Canada, United States, France, Germany, Great Britain, all these countries built him up, you know, because he was against Iran.
Yeah.
And he was a good guy in those days, you know, and all of a sudden he became the butcher of the Middle East, you know, and the Middle East madman. And I'm thinking, compared to who, you know, who over there is sane who leads the government, you know? They're all quite crazy as far as I can see, you know. That's my opinion. The other thing is that, you know, if somebody, you know, blows somebody up, it's a terrorist act. But if somebody drops a 34,000-pound bomb on them, it's, you know, conventional warfare. Or if somebody...
establishing peace and democracy.
Yeah, fires, depleted uranium shells, which, you know, poison the water and cause cancer and can't be removed. That's freedom and democracy, you know. I'm not quite sure I buy any of that, you know.
History far better than I do.
I think the whole thing is a big lie, you know. I think it's an atrocious lie.
I guess if you look back on American history, really, I mean, you see the Americans supporting a series of dictators and tyrants, don't you? Like,
absolutely, you know.
Just according to their purpose.
Yeah, the whole history of the 20th century, you know, is that. I mean, I read a very good book by Marilyn Young on Vietnam, and really, you know, all the Vietnamese people wanted to do was have their own government, and if they had been allowed to have a free vote, Ho Chi Minh would have been overwhelmingly voted in. He was the father of their country, you know. He based his constitution on the American Constitution, but he was a communist, so, you know, millions of people had to die because he was a communist.
Yeah, 2 million Vietnamese.
Americans, and which is horrible, you know.
Yeah,
what a waste, not a waste if you're making weapons, you know, and if that's what your business is, and that's the other reality behind all this. It is.
It's like seeing the corporate giants that benefit, make money off the war machine, and then the oil and weapons, and then the pharmaceuticals that are thrown in.
It's like Catch-22, you know, which is the greatest anti-war book I think ever written, but, you know, in one scene there in the book, Milo Minderbinder, who's always making money, pays the Germans to bomb the American air base, you know, and Rudy's mad at him, but he says, well, they're our partners, you know, and nothing should get ahead of a buck, you know, and then basically, I always thought that was kind of like completely over the top, but in fact, that's basically the truth, you know, wherever there's money to be made, you know. I mean, the DuPonts did business with the Germans. The DuPonts were Jewish, and they did business with the Germans during the Second World War.
Yeah.
You know?
Wasn't it George Bush's grandfather who worked with Hitler and was then charged at the end of the war with doing business with Hitler during the war period?
Really?
I've seen that. It was on Information Clearinghouse that I read. Yeah, Prescott Bush was supported, did business with the Nazis during the war period.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I partly, what, I mean, even for me now, like, I question, I think there's a whole other level to the Second World War that I'm not sure we know. I don't know anymore. It's like, you know, I had my kind of illusory understanding of modern history, which I held to about 6 months ago, and then I kind of had this profound shock of waking up and realized the 9/11 hoax. And then you kind of look at it from there and you begin, well, how has the Western civilization been so totally deceived as to what was really happening? Mm-hmm. And then, wow, it's the media. Okay, all the media. So you begin to kind of realize more and more what the beast in modern times has become, you know, and you know, how these things are done and how, you know, we think we're kind of spreading democracy and saving these people, but really we've become the imperialist aggressors, kind of invading another country and terrible things, you know. I really think between now and 2012, I just see as a very critical time in human history. I think these things are going to come to a head. Not that I've never been into psychical predictions, but that's really my sense of the urgency of modern times. There's this terrible, terrible beast which has kind of infected so much of our society at different levels, you know, into the police services and intelligence and services and corporate world and so on, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you something which I was thinking about a little while ago, which was, you know, we were talking a little bit about light and I mean, in a way that one of the things that really provides an interesting model for how all of these extraordinary claims can be reasonable and rational is the holographic model of consciousness and I was thinking the other day, it's interesting, about, I think it was about 25 years ago that there was a book, The Holographic Paradigm, in which people talked about holography
Wilbur's book.
Ken Wilbur's book, yeah, and David Bohm, a physicist, had kind of come out with this holographic model of creation, and Carl Prebram, who is a very prominent neuroscientist, specialist in memory, had kind of developed this idea that really memory was organized in the brain holographically according to holographic principles. And I guess I have a couple of things. My question was, why do you think it's funny, like, how that model hasn't really gone anywhere, and yet it seems to me it's like it's so consistent with so much information that I would have thought that somehow that this would have taken off and that this would have been developed by more people, and yet there seems to have been very little work done in terms of that. Why do you think that is?
Wow, yeah, it's so interesting. A complex question. I think one thing was, okay, so just maybe I'll just say a few things about holography.
Yeah,
maybe feel like some listeners may not be aware of what that is. But the actual physical technique of creating a hologram, is that you have a laser source of light. So you have a point source of coherent light. And that is divided by a partly covered mirror. So that half of it, the light, impresses directly on the holographic film, okay? And the second half of the light bounces off an object, say an apple. And then that wavefront also then interpenetrates on the holographic film. So on the holographic plate, you have these two interacting wavefronts, what's called an object beam and a referent beam, okay? Now, so the thing unique about a holographic plate is that if you cut any part, say you had a 2-foot by 2-foot holographic plate, and if you cut any part of that holographic plate, you cut it out and you projected, you put a laser behind it and projected that an image out into space, each part of that holographic plate would contain an image of the whole of the apple. So the idea in holography is that the whole is kind of within any part. So that's the basic concept of holography, the whole being written into a part. Now, when Prebrum applied it to psychology, he at one point, in my view, why the holographic paradigm never developed in modern psychology was that nobody ever considered that there might be a light source within a human being. See, if you have no laser light in the holographic setup, there is no holograph. You have to have a laser light, a point source of coherent light. Okay, and it's because of this light that then you can create holographic images. But Prebrum, in applying the idea to psychology, never thought or considered that there might be any interior light within the human being that could act the equivalent of the laser beam in the holographic setup. That's why once in an interview in Omni magazine, the interviewer asked him and said, I didn't understand. Are you saying that there are some... I used to think you meant there were some kind of laser beams in the brain. And Prebrum then said, no. He says, really, we developed the holographic paradigm because the methods of Fourier transforms, which is a mathematical procedure for breaking down complex waves into their component waves, a Fourier transforms can be used to analyze data from all different areas of psychology. It's the same mathematics that show that psychological phenomena kind of follow wave mechanics and wave principles. But he said that there are no laser beams in the brain,
Prebrum said.
Now, firstly, he is saying this, so he's saying, what he's saying is there's no inherent light source within the human being. So that was never part of the holographic paradigm.
Right.
The holographic paradigm was to use to say, oh, everything's a wave, and everything kind of interferes, and information can be spread out over areas. Okay. But no one ever considered that there might indeed be an inner light source, which is what, like if you look at my writing, that's what's so unique. What I've done is taken, like in the Bhagavad Gita, the self, the jiva atma within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating like the sun.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have an inherently self-illuminating element within the heart. Well, this is your laser light.
Right.
You see? If you have that model of this mass of unemergent light called the bliss sheath, well, you stick a mass of unemergent light within the heart, and then you could have the basis by which there might be an inner circulation of electromagnetic and light influences within the human being from the heart center. So it gives you, so if you have a mystical perspective on the holographic paradigm, then you actually have a coherent source of pure light. And you never had that. And in mysticism, it also makes sense, like you, in holography, you have the object beam and the referent beam. Well, I would say the referent beam is like pure light consciousness. Okay, it doesn't interact with any material objects, okay?
Right.
And then you have the object-bound consciousness, which is like consciousness of apples and bananas and houses and people, consciousness of things.
Right.
Okay? But the ultimate, on the holographic plate, what you have is the interaction. You have this like pure light consciousness is there as well. See, there's not just the object consciousness.
Right.
The hologram is created by the fact of there being this pure light consciousness, because that establishes like the ground level or the zero point level, and then it interacts with the object consciousness. And I think human consciousness is the same. Most of our consciousness is purely in the object beams, and our consciousness is so tied up with the object beams. But always, I think there's that background of pure consciousness that enables the human holograph to work. There has to be at some level. So to me, that's one major aspect of why the holographic paradigm didn't develop properly. No one considered seriously the concept of there being a light source within the interior nature of the human being. So to me, that's part of it, and there's many other aspects to it. I think another thing, the idea of holography and consciousness as light, and then it's so interesting because if we look at the nature of light, and if we divide white light by a three-sided prism and get a spectrum of seven colors, well, if a human being is a hologram, and light follows this kind of rule of one divided by three that gives seven, like there's these different elements in light, if we apply that to consciousness, yeah, we can apply that principle then of the one, the three, and the seven, we can apply that to understanding a human hologram, a human being as a hologram. So then I would say your one is within the heart, and then you have three channels connect seven centers. So I would say there's a whole inner circulation of light that underlies and interpenetrates the material form.
Wow.
Okay, so it's because of this referent beam. It's part of the referent beam in a sense. It's because of the presence of that light consciousness that then the neurological processes go on in the head and you have different thoughts, but there's that consciousness that can be aware of those thoughts. It's a very complex subject, and I'm still trying to learn and explore myself. Did you have time to have a look at that material by the doctor I referred you to?
Yeah, I did. I just kind of got a quick overview.
I was going to go into his work more. It's Dr. Bigelson.
Yeah.
And he talks about, I'll just read a little few sections of his. I haven't had time to research it closely well, but he's doing work with Emoto. Like, Emoto shows something. You're familiar with Emoto's work, eh, Jim? Emoto is a Japanese researcher who has a way of doing the studies of the crystalline structure of frozen water molecules, okay?
And
he takes water from various sources.
Oh,
and he shows their kind of downbroken structures, and then people can pray all over them or put negative feelings into water. And the very fact of what feelings are put into the water seems to then affect the crystalline structure of what is in the water. Okay? Even if you had one jug of water on your table and you put a piece of paper with the word peace on it, and you put it on top of that glass, and then you took some of that water and froze it and examined its crystalline structure, it would give you these beautiful Star of David forms, because it's all crystalline waters in Star of David patterns, eh? Like all snowflakes are, eh?
Yeah.
They're six-pointed. They all embody that kind of design.
So that's kind of consistent with Bernard Grad's work years ago about the difference in the properties of water held by people who were healers versus the control group.
Yeah, and the plants grew better with the healer's water.
He actually found that the plants actually were healthier and grew better.
So that all kind of proves in a way the idea of how human emotions and thoughts can affect matter at like quantum levels.
Yeah.
Okay. So then in Bigelson's work, he sees the blood as very, very important to holographic, what does he call it? I'm sorry, I misplaced my notes on him, but he says, a pioneer in providing the medicine of the future. So he measures the effects of types of human experiences and subjective factors in disease and wellness, through his discoveries in holographic blood analysis. And what he says is all the diseases of the body are all imaged or pictured in the blood. So he's looking at the blood as the basis for the human holography.
Yeah, that's what I see when I was reading about him, and he says at first he thought he was kind of projecting things, like he was like kids, seeing animals in the clouds, and he said, but he actually could see these images, and I'm thinking about, but I didn't understand what that entails, but it's quite fascinating, and so but what he's saying is quite consistent with like a holographic idea, which is that all of the parts contain the whole, so blood. In terms of consciousness, is very important in a mystical perspective, and this would be quite consistent that somehow that the blood contains the information about the whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah. That's
if this is if he can develop this, this is like boy, this that's astounding in terms of like the possibilities for diagnosis and treatment. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know all how he means. I'm going to try to research his work because I know it's
I couldn't find that much. I just glanced at it, but I couldn't find that much of an explanation, and I didn't really quite get what he was, what he was saying. So,
Yeah. I mean, see, one thing it ties in so much to what I say in my work is that consciousness, I say, is connected to the heart and then to the circulation of blood.
Blood.
And I argue that the flow of consciousness through the body is related to blood flow. Okay, because like in modern psychology, if you're conscious in your feet, this modern theorist thinks that the consciousness of feet is really up in your sensory motor strip in your cortex.
Right.
And I would say that's wrong. You may think about your feet and analyze a sensation up in your head, but your actual experience of your feet is in your feet, I would argue. Okay, it's not that everything outside of the head is only experienced up in the head. I'm saying that we can experience ourselves throughout ourselves, and it's related to blood flow.
Yeah,
that's why I say you eat a big meal and you're stuffed, and it feels like your consciousness is in your stomach, as indeed it is, because you're digesting your food.
Oh,
so that the consciousness is connected to blood flow.
Yeah, the most obvious example of that is when you're sexually aroused, the blood flow is to your organs, to your sexual organs. It's not in your head,
Yeah.
I mean, a man's penis doesn't become erect in his brain. It becomes erect in his penis, So the blood flow increases to your penis. That's what causes an erection,
Yeah.
I mean, it's so obvious.
So this is a whole, this is like what he's suggesting. I mean, it's not as revolutionary as what I suggest, but he also, as a doctor, is starting to say, oh, maybe consciousness is connected to the blood flow.
Yeah.
That he's the first person I've encountered who kind of argues similarly to what I've argued now for years.
Yeah.
That consciousness circulates through the body connected to blood flow. But then I argue there's also subtle bodies and subtle blood flow. So it's not only the blood flow in the material body, but the blood flow or circulation of energies in the subtle body. So it's a complex issue, what is meant by blood flow. But in the mystical teachings, again, we find that mystics describe the body as ensouled through the breath, and that the self within the heart, the Prabhupada describes this in his explanations of yoga and the Gita. He said the corpuscles that travel out from the lungs, they gather soul, they distribute the soul energies through the hemoglobin.
Hmm.
The hemoglobin's an iron element, and it brings down the air element, which allows the fire to be brought down, the life, into the material body. And it's anchored by the hemoglobin in the blood. So that's like I would see the self within the heart, the light, that might be the fire element. And then the air is the air element. And that air element allows that higher principle to be brought down through and diffused through the body, through the blood. So anyway, so I would argue this idea that consciousness connected to the blood flow. And then it's interesting to see a doctor like this beginning to realize how so much the blood reflects your whole pattern of sickness and illnesses in the whole body, even emotionally, and your thoughts, he's saying.
Yeah.
Like if you think of Emoto's research, how important that is, if you can pray over water and then affect that the crystalline structure of that water. Well, I mean, we are, 80% water, 90%? I'm not really sure. But if we can do that on ourselves, influence the matter and water base of our own selves and our own chemistry and biochemistry.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I'm saying.
The implications are, pretty extraordinary. I mean, and also, too, I mean, I was thinking, like, there's also Pearson's work on the heart, which is, again, quite revolutionary in the sense that he emphasizes the importance of the heart, which is, completely congruent with your ideas about how important the heart is in our well-being and in terms of our experience, and that science has really not recognized the importance of the heart, that it's much more than a mechanical pump.
Yeah.
I mean, I was really struck, too. I was just going to say that I think I mentioned on a previous program, reading that book by Susan Blackmore, who's a British psychologist, did a book called Conversations on Consciousness with about 20 different leading consciousness researchers in the world. And in reading that book, the thing that really struck me more than anything else was that it was all about people's brains, and that realistically, almost all the discussions, with very few exceptions, there were a couple of people that kind of got out of this trap, I would say, that it all focused on people's brains. So it was like you wouldn't even need a body, according to these people, to be conscious, that they in no way related their discussion of the nature of consciousness to the actual physical being of a human being. It was all kind of centered up in the head. And there was no other kind of consideration, no consideration of even like subcortical mechanisms in terms of, in terms of the brain. It was just basically, it was about the cortex. And I was thinking, like, what an incredibly peculiar understanding of things, but I can explain how it's happened historically in terms of the history of Western science and the history of Western psychology, because progressively all consciousness and spirit and animism have been withdrawn from the universe, and in terms of consideration of psychology, it has been posited to exist solely in the brain. And like I say, so you really end up with these kind of disembodied figures who are just big brains that are conscious beings, according to these guys, which, if nothing else, that's completely wrong. I mean, that's just not right.
Yeah. So, right. I mean, to actually then, have this idea, consciousness connected to the blood, and there's so many self-observations that corresponds to, like you can try to understand that in your own self-experience.
Yeah.
The dynamics of that, it seems so intelligible.
Yeah, I mean, and of course it's consistent with, yoga principles and all principles about breathing, is that you're increasing oxygenation of the blood, right?
You're ensouling the body more.
Yeah, and those ideas, I mean, I think it's in Yogananda, he talks about, that the Kriya Yogi spiritually magnetizes the cells by infusing them with light. And through breath, mastery of breath. And I mean, it's a very sophisticated explanation of how they do this, and the fact that, for thousands of years, yogis knew that all sorts of processes that Western science ended up regarding as being autonomic are actually under voluntary control, and it wasn't until the 60s that Western science realized through the study of biofeedback, these processes are not necessarily automatic, that they can actually be controlled. And I would say that that's much more true of the body than Western science recognizes, that so much more of it is under potential control, control. But you have to develop the level of consciousness to do it.
Yeah, so the whole idea of consciousness connected to the blood is really very interesting and important. And then, see, you mentioned Pearsall's book. See, in Pearsall's book, he mentions that the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 10,000 times the electromagnetic volume of the mind in the brain in the head.
Right.
So if that is true, then the human being as a quantum system, okay, like then the center of the human being as a quantum system, as an electromagnetic system, is the heart.
Right.
Okay, because everything in nature is electromagnetic. Everything.
Right.
Everything is electromagnetic. Light is one form of electromagnetic radiation, but everything is electromagnetic. All the cellular processes, all material organization, all evolves electromagnetic forces. So if the human being, if the heart has the electromagnetic volume 10,000 times that of, or 5,000 of the mind, then the heart is clearly the center of a human being as a quantum system, which is what we are, a living organism. Living, breathing organism.
Right.
So if we see the heart then, and I was saying earlier about there being this mass of unemergent light associated with the heart, so I'm suggesting there's actual physics to this, that there is this underlying light which is distributed through these 1-3-7 patterns, through the subtle anatomy and through the chakras. So there's this whole underpinning, the light body that underlies and sustains and interpenetrates the material body. I don't believe it forms the material body. Aspects of it take part in forming it. But so what I'm saying about, if we want a holographic model which has to do with light and waves and interaction of waves and memory of waves, then, and look at the human being, well, the central electromagnetic center is the heart, and then all the processes of the oxygenation of the body, that is what brings life and vitality all through the body, because all cellular processes require oxygenation. So it is through the blood that life is brought into the body. I mean, scientists would agree with that, because, you deprive any part of the body of oxygen, it begins dying within seconds, minutes.
Yeah.
But anyway, so then, you know, this idea that consciousness is light, and then that might be, light might be stepped down in a way, in different levels of that light, and then it can be fused through the blood and through the electrodynamics of the heart and the blood. So there's a whole electrodynamics to the blood. So the fact that here's a scientist, a biologist, beginning to say, wow, you know, look at, the blood can be viewed as a hologram. Everything that happens in your psychology is kind of reflected in your blood. And that's more similar to what the mystics have said, that they say that the memory is carried in the blood and that things are pictured in our blood. I haven't got the quotes available to me at the moment, but they also talk about how we can refine our blood, and if we refine our blood, we have finer elements in the blood, so the blood can have this sun element in it. It's like the pure light of consciousness. That element can be in your blood more or less.
Hmm.
You see, so the quality of the blood in this view would also vary. Like Gurdjieff talks about the blood of the astral body and the blood of the mental body. So we might have these different subtleness of light and electrodynamics, all related to the blood flow. So it's certainly a different model. And as you say, Blackmore and so many scientists just all assume that consciousness is only up somewhere in the cerebral cortex. And it's such a limited view once you begin to consider alternative perspectives.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that is repeated a couple of times in that book by a couple of different people is that, and which really struck me, is that they're talking about how vitalism had been driven out of biology. Well, not driven, proven not to be necessary, you know. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, you know. The idea of like Bergson's élan vital or some sort of subtle energy and some sort of life principle has been dismissed by biology. But I mean, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think that there's all sorts of anomalous evidence which suggests that we have to recognize that, and that there is some sort of subtle realm that functions and interacts with the material body. And again, it's one of those. it's one of those assumptions that works on a certain level and works within a certain framework, but which really ultimately doesn't lead to a more comprehensive understanding of things. You know,
Yeah, vitalism was never disproved.
Instead, it was
just the tide turned and people dismissed it. Not on the scientific base, but just
spirit,
on the...
Spirit has never been disproved scientifically. You know, the existence of spirit and the existence of animism even, you know. I mean, and in fact, you know, there's a book out, and I haven't been able to find out too much about it, but I thought of you when I saw it right away. It's by Stanley Krippner and a couple of other people. Stanley Krippner was a prominent parapsychologist, it's called The Varieties of Anomalous Experiences, and I think it's like an encyclopedia of anomalous experiences which stand outside of, you know, the established scientific framework for explaining things. And it reminded me of that great quote that you know, you always cite from Uspensky when he was talking about science, and he said, you know, if you added up all the system-destroying facts, which, you know, confront the limits of science, you know, you'd realize kind of that the lack of comprehensiveness and the limits of science as it's...
Yeah, he says it would wash away everything we thought we knew.
Better, yeah.
If we could collect all the enigmas.
Yeah. I knew I wasn't getting to the punchline. Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of the way I feel about, you know, just the more I consider the status of science, especially from, and this is the great thing about the mystical esoteric perspective, it just provides such a comprehensive and such an intelligent perspective to understand these issues that are taken for granted and are part of the kind of conventional thinking about everything, you know? Every time I hear somebody talk about the left brain and the right brain, you know, I don't know whether to cry or to throw up, you know? I mean, it's like, people, you know, just believe things that because somebody said it, you know, or even like, you know, I was thinking about this the other day about the projection of when I was reading Carl Sagan, he was talking about how, you know, religious ideas are kind of tainted because they're culturally specific. And I'm thinking, well, all the science is like that. You know, all sorts of ideas creep into science, which are, you know, projections of a certain time in history and certain ideas, you know, like, I mean, Freud's whole theory about energy was based on, you know, was based on, hydraulics, you know. Hydraulics had been invented, and it kind of reflected that. And, you know, you hear people talk about the human biocomputer all the time. Well, that's a useful metaphor, but that's all it is. Human beings aren't computers.
Well, I think it is. I think that's a very important metaphor, computer, because, you know, one way, the way I see it, like I would say the heart is the basic the center of the human biochemical computer. That the heart is a biochemical computer. And on the subtle planes, it's a computer. And that everything that's ever happened is all computed in the heart, in the ethers of the heart. So that's kind of how I see it. Because compute means information. And I see the heart is in information fields, and it can extract from the information fields. So I like this biocomputers.
I think there's a lot of the danger in that, though, because I think people really think we are computers. I don't agree with that at all. I think you know, it's another way of expressing intelligence, but it is a metaphor, you know. Like when somebody invents a different kind of computer, you know, we'll have a different understanding of what we mean by computing. I mean, you're right.
I wouldn't want to take it just in terms of how people think of computers.
Yeah, I sort of agree with you. When you put it that way, I understand what you say, but it's dangerous. But the basic point is that we do kind of project our understanding of things in terms of things we know. Our understanding of the unknown is explained in terms of what we know. And, you know, I mean, you have to do that to a certain extent, but it can be kind of dangerous, because then it becomes it becomes part of the conventional thinking about things, and people accept it as kind of, you know, oh, that's the way to think about it. And the danger is it stops you from thinking about things in other ways.
Yeah, it becomes formatory, like it's just
a label
you put on it, and you think you understand it. And
we can name it now, we understand it, but,
and
as I say, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, it always has to happen that way because we have to try to understand things in terms of things we do know. And we, you know, we're talking about holograms. Well, I mean, you know, that's a good analogy, but maybe that's all it is. You know, I mean, I'm sure there's much more to it than even that. But it's a good way of thinking about things. But
you can't be
too identified with it. You know.
And then we'll come back to holography and that next week, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the new models in physics of holographic views in physics. I think that's really important.
Because
that's
really,
really quite profound. And I see we just have a few minutes left here. I mentioned we started a few minutes late, but I was going to try to end on time on the hour. I'll just leave a few more notes and then this was Christopher Holmes and James Moffat on Zero Point Radio this week. I invite you to visit www.zeropoint.ca, and I have my email address up there. We appreciate any feedback about the show. I think next time we'll try to open the show up for the second hour and take in any callers. Okay, otherwise,
we should have people go to, if they're listening, and check out all the other great programs on BBS Radio. It's a fantastic service and has a really interesting variety of speakers and topics that are covered on a regular basis. It's a great service.
Yeah, and they provide a lot more services, too. I can even have a chat room. I've never had the time to put enough time into developing my section up on the site. I'll make an effort to do that, and they can even have a forum up there, and that might be useful to learn how to contribute to that.
And your previous programs are archived, too, which is...
Yeah, we have a lot of material up there now. It's really quite thrilling to have so much up there. Okay, so, we've covered quite a... we started coming to this holography, idea of holography and light, and I think that's good for us to come back to that. And it just fits in with everything because, I mean, you talk about being enlightened or living in the light.
Or being illuminated.
And so it's very literal. Like if a person is more conscious, you experience greater inward illumination. Sometimes you can be flooded with inner illumination. Other times it's just more subtle. But in early Christian teachings, they talked about light gaining.
Yeah.
So in a way, that's what we want to learn to do. We want to learn to live in the light. And the Gurdjieff teaching, we struggle against negative emotions and imagination and the turning of the mind to bring our attention back to the moment. Okay, so just all listeners, let's all try to keep heart. But we do live in a very, very dangerous, precarious time, I think. So it stresses the importance of us all making efforts to awaken and become more conscious of ourselves and what's happening around us in the world, and to keep heart and keep to help to awaken that sense of self within the lotus of the heart. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Chris.
Be back 2 weeks. Thanks, Don and Doug, and BBS Radio.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Good night.
Bye.